Finally, the connection clicked open. Rachel felt a surge of relief, but it was short-lived. There was no one on the line. Only silence. "Hello?" she prompted. "Director?" Three quick clicks. "Hello?" Rachel said. A burst of electronic static shattered the line, blasting in Rachel's ear. She yanked the receiver away from her head in pain. The static abruptly stopped. Now she could hear a series of rapidly oscillating tones that pulsed in half-second intervals. Rachel's confusion quickly gave way to realization, and then fear. Shit! Wheeling back to the controls on the bridge, she slammed the receiver down in its cradle, severing the connection. For several moments she stood terrified, wondering if she'd hung up in time. Amidships, two decks below, the Goya's Hydro Lab was an expansive workspace segmented by long counters and islands packed to the gills with electronic gear. Bottom profilers, current analyzers, wet sinks, fume hoods, a walk-in specimen cooler, PCs, and a stack of organizer crates for research data and the spare electronics to keep everything running. When Tolland and Corky entered, the Goya's onboard geologist, Xavier, was reclining in front of a blaring television. She didn't even turn around. "Did you guys run out of beer money?" she called over her shoulder, apparently thinking some of her crew had returned. "Xavier," Tolland said, "it's Mike." The geologist spun, swallowing part of a prepackaged sandwich she was eating. "Mike!" she stammered, clearly stunned to see him. She stood up, turned down the television, and came over, still chewing. "I thought some of the guys had come back from bar hopping. What are you doing here?" Xavier was heavy-set and dark-skinned, with a sharp voice and a surly air about her. She motioned at the television, which was broadcasting replays of Tolland's on-site meteorite documentary. "You sure didn't hang around the ice shelf very long, did you?" Something came up, Tolland thought. "Xavier, I'm sure you recognize Corky Marlinson." Xavier nodded. "An honor, sir." Corky was eyeing the sandwich in her hand. "That looks good." Xavier gave him an odd look. "I got your message," Tolland said to Xavier. "You said I made a mistake in my presentation? I want to talk to you about it." The geologist stared at him and let out a shrill laugh. "That's why you're back? Oh, Mike, for God's sake, I told you it was nothing. I was just pulling your chain. NASA obviously gave you some old data. Inconsequential." "Seriously, only three or four marine geologists in the world might have noticed the oversight." Tolland held his breath. "This oversight, does it by any chance have anything to do with the chondrils?" Xavier's face went blank with shock. "My God, one of those geologists called you already?" Tolland slumped. "The chondrils." He looked at Corky and then back to the marine geologist. "Xavier, I need to know everything you can tell me about these chondrils. What was the mistake I made?" Xavier stared at him, apparently now sensing he was dead serious. "Mike, it's really nothing. I read a small article in a trade journal a while back, but I don't understand why you're so worried about this." Tolland sighed. "Xavier, as strange as this may sound, the less you know tonight, the better. All I'm asking is for you to tell us what you know about chondrils, and then we'll need you to examine a rock sample for us." Xavier looked mystified and vaguely perturbed to be out of the loop. "Fine, let me get you that article. It's in my office." She set her sandwich down and headed for the door. Corky called after her. "Can I finish that?" Xavier paused, sounding incredulous. "You want to finish my sandwich?" "Well, I just thought if you..." "Get your own damn sandwich." Xavier left. Tolland chuckled, motioning across the lab toward a specimen cooler. "Bottom shelf, Corky, between the sambuca and squid sacks." Outside, on deck, Rachel descended the steep stairway from the bridge and strode toward the chopper pad. The Coast Guard pilot was dozing but sat up when Rachel rapped on the cockpit. "Done already?" he asked. "That was fast." Rachel shook her head, on edge. "Can you run both surface and air radar?" "Sure, 10-mile radius. Turn it on, please." Looking puzzled, the pilot threw a couple of switches, and the radar screen lit up. The sweep arms spun lazy circles. "Anything?" Rachel asked. The pilot let the arm make several complete rotations. He adjusted some controls and watched. It was all clear. "A couple of small ships way out on the periphery, but they're heading away from us. We're clear. Miles and miles of open sea in all directions." Rachel sighed, although she didn't feel particularly relieved. "Do me a favor. If you see anything approaching, boats, aircraft, anything, will you let me know immediately?"
"Sure thing. Is everything okay?"
"Yeah. I'd just like to know if we're having company." The pilot shrugged.
"I'll watch the radar, ma'am. If anything blips, you'll be the first to know."
Rach's senses were tingling as she headed for the hydro lab. When she entered, Corky and Tolland were standing alone in front of a computer monitor and chewing sandwiches. Corky called out to her with his mouth full.
"What'll it be? Fishy chicken, fishy bologna, or fishy egg salad?"
Rachel barely heard the question.
"Mike, how fast can we get this information and get off this ship?"
Chapter 104. Tolland paced the hydro lab, waiting with Rachel and Corky for Xavier's return. The news about the Condrills was almost as discomforting as Rachel's news about her attempted contact with Pickering. The director didn't answer, and someone tried to pulse-snitch the Goya's location.
"Relax," Tolland told everyone. "We're safe. The Coast Guard pilot is watching the radar. He can give us plenty of warning if anyone is headed our way."
Rachel nodded in agreement, although she still looked on edge.
"Mike, what the hell is this?"
Corky asked, pointing at a Spark computer monitor, which displayed an ominous psychedelic image that was pulsating and churning as though alive.
"Acoustic Doppler current profiler," Tolland said. "It's a cross-section of the currents and temperature gradients of the ocean underneath the ship."
Rachel stared.
"That's what we're anchored on top of?"
Tolland had to admit the image looked frightening. At the surface, the water appeared as a swirling, bluish-green. But tracing downward, the colors slowly shifted to a menacing red-orange as the temperatures heated up. Near the bottom, over a mile down, hovering above the ocean floor, a blood-red cyclone vortex raged.
"That's the megaplume," Tolland said.
Corky grunted.
"Looks like an underwater tornado."
"Same principle. Oceans are usually colder and more dense near the bottom. But here, the dynamics are reversed. The deep water is heated and lighter, so it rises toward the surface. Meanwhile, the surface water is heavier, so it races downward in a huge spiral to fill the void. You get these drain-like currents in the ocean. Enormous whirlpools."
"What's that big bump on the seafloor?"
Corky pointed at the flat expanse of ocean floor where a large dome-shaped mound rose up like a bubble. Directly above it swirled the vortex.
"That mound is a magma dome," Tolland said. "It's where lava is pushing up beneath the ocean floor."
Corky nodded.
"Like a huge zit."
"In a manner of speaking."
"And if it pops?"
Tolland frowned, recalling the famous 1986 megaplume event off the Juan de Fuca Ridge, where thousands of tons of 1,200 degrees Celsius magma spewed up into the ocean all at once, magnifying the plume's intensity almost instantly. Surface currents amplified as the vortex expanded rapidly upward. What happened next was something Tolland had no intention of sharing with Corky and Rachel this evening.
"Atlantic magma domes don't pop," Tolland said. "The cold water circulating over the mound continually cools and hardens the Earth's crust, keeping the magma safely under a thick layer of rock. Eventually, the lava underneath cools and the spiral disappears. Megaplumes are generally not dangerous."
Corky pointed toward a tattered magazine sitting near the computer.
So you're saying Scientific American publishes fiction?
Tallon saw the cover and winced. Someone had apparently pulled it from the Goya's archive of old science magazines. Scientific American, February 1999. The cover showed an artist's rendering of a supertanker swirling out of control in an enormous funnel of ocean. The heading read, Mega Plumes, Giant Killers from the Deep. Tallon laughed it off. Totally irrelevant. That article is talking about mega plumes in earthquake zones. It was a popular Bermuda Triangle hypothesis a few years back, explaining ship disappearances. Technically speaking, if there's some sort of cataclysmic geologic event on the ocean floor, which is unheard of around here, the dome could rupture and the vortex could get big enough to, well, you know.
No, we don't know,
Corky said. Tallon shrugged. Rise to the surface.
Terrific. So glad you had us aboard.
Xavier entered, carrying some papers. Admiring the megaplume?
Oh, yes, Corky said sarcastically. Mike was just telling us how if that little mound ruptures, we all go spiraling around in a big drain.
Drain? Xavier gave a cold laugh. More like getting flushed down the world's largest toilet. Outside on the deck of the Goya, the Coast Guard helicopter pilot vigilantly watched the EMS radar screen. As a rescue pilot, he had seen his share of fear in people's eyes. Rachel Sexton had definitely been afraid when she asked him to keep an eye out for unexpected visitors to the Goya. What kind of visitors is she expecting? He wondered. From all the pilot could see, the sea and air for 10 miles in all directions contained nothing that looked out of the ordinary. A fishing boat 8 miles off, an occasional aircraft slicing across an edge of their radar field and then disappearing again towards some unknown destination. The pilot sighed, gazing out now at the ocean rushing all around the ship. The sensation was a ghostly one, that of sailing full speed despite being anchored. He returned his eyes to the radar screen and watched, vigilant. Chapter 105. On board the Goya, Tallon had now introduced Xavier and Rachel. The ship's geologist was looking increasingly baffled by the distinguished entourage standing before her in the hydrolab. In addition, Rachel's eagerness to run the tests and get off the ship as fast as possible was clearly making Xavier uneasy. Take your time, Xavier, Tallon willed her. We need to know everything. Xavier was talking now, her voice stiff. In your documentary, Mike, you said those little metallic inclusions in the rock could form only in space. Tallon already felt a tremor of apprehension. Chondrules form only in space. That's what NASA told me. But according to these notes, Xavier said, holding up the pages, that's not entirely true. Corky glared. Of course it's true. Xavier scowled at Corky and waved the notes. Last year, a young geologist named Lee Pollock out of Drew University was using a new breed of marine robot to do Pacific deep water crust sampling in the Mariana Trench and pulled up a loose rock that contained a geologic feature he had never seen before. The feature was quite similar in appearance to chondrules. He called them plagioclase stress inclusions, tiny bubbles of metal that apparently had been rehomogenized during deep ocean pressurization events. Dr. Pollock was amazed to find metallic bubbles in an ocean rock, and he formulated a unique theory to explain their presence. Corky grumbled.
I suppose he would have to.
Xavier ignored him. Dr. Pollock asserted that the rock formed in an ultra-deep oceanic environment, where extreme pressure metamorphosed a pre-existing rock, permitting some of the disparate metals to fuse. Tallon considered it. The Mariana Trench was 7 miles down, one of the last truly unexplored regions on the planet. Only a handful of robotic probes had ever ventured that deep, and most had collapsed well before they reached the bottom. The water pressure in the trench was enormous, an astounding 18,000 pounds per square inch, as opposed to a mere 14 pounds on the ocean surface. Oceanographers still had very little understanding of the geologic forces at the deepest ocean floor. So this guy, Pollock, thinks the Mariana Trench can make rocks with chondrule-like features?
It's an extremely obscure theory, Xavier said. In fact, it's never even been formally published. I only happened to stumble across Pollock's personal notes on the web by chance last month when I was doing research on fluid rock interactions for our upcoming Megaplume show. Otherwise, I never would have heard of it.
The theory has never been published, Corky said, because it's ridiculous. You need heat to form chondrules. There's no way water pressure could rearrange the crystalline structure of a rock.
Pressure, Xavier fired back, happens to be the single biggest contributor to geologic change on our planet. A little something called a metamorphic rock? Geology 101?
Corky scowled. Tallon realized Xavier had a point. Although heat did play a role in some of Earth's metamorphic geology, most metamorphic rocks were formed by extreme pressure. Incredibly, rocks deep in the Earth's crust were under so much pressure that they acted more like thick molasses than solid rock, becoming elastic and undergoing chemical changes as they did. Nonetheless, Dr. Pollock's theory still seemed like a stretch.
Xavier, Tallon said, I've never heard of water pressure alone chemically altering a rock. You're the geologist. What's your take?
Well, she said, flipping through her notes, it sounds like water pressure isn't the only factor.
Xavier found a passage and read Pollock's notes verbatim.
Oceanic crust in the Mariana Trench, already under enormous hydrostatic pressurization, can find itself further compressed by tectonic forces from the region's subduction zones.
Of course, Tallon thought. The Mariana Trench, in addition to being crushed under 7 miles of water, was a subduction zone. The compression line where the Pacific and Indian plates moved toward one another and collided. Combined pressures in the trench could be enormous. And because the area was so remote and dangerous to study, if there were chondrules down there, chances of anyone knowing about it were very slim.
Xavier kept reading.
Combined hydrostatic and tectonic pressures could potentially force crust into an elastic or semi-liquid state, allowing lighter elements to fuse into chondrule-like structures thought to occur only in space.
Corky rolled his eyes.
Impossible!
Tallon glanced at Corky.
Is there any alternative explanation for the chondrules on the rock Dr. Pollock found?
Easy, Corky said. Pollock found an actual meteorite. Meteorites fall into the ocean all the time. Pollock wouldn't have suspected it was a meteorite because the fusion crust would have eroded away from years under the water, making it look like a normal rock.
Corky turned to Xavier.
I don't suppose Pollock had the brains to measure the nickel content, did he?
Actually, yes, Xavier fired back, flipping through the notes again.
Pollock writes, I was surprised to find the nickel content of the specimen falling within a mid-range value not usually associated with terrestrial rocks.
Tallon and Rachel exchanged startled looks.
Xavier continued reading.
Although the quantity of nickel does not fall within the normally acceptable mid-range window for meteoric origin, it is surprisingly close.
Rachel looked troubled.
How close? Is there any way this ocean rock could be mistaken for a meteorite?
Xavier shook her head.
I'm not a chemical petrologist, but as I understand it, there are numerous chemical differences between the rock Pollock found and actual meteorites.
What are those differences? Tallon pressed.
Xavier turned her attention to a graph in her notes.
According to this, one difference is in the chemical structure of the chondrules themselves. It looks like the titanium-zirconium ratios differ. The titanium-zirconium ratio in the chondrules of the ocean sample showed ultra-depleted zirconium.
She looked up.
Only 2 parts per million.
2 ppm? Corky blurted. Meteorites have thousands of times that.
Exactly, Xavier replied, which is why Pollock thinks his sample's chondrules are not from space.
Tallon leaned over and whispered to Corky.
Did NASA happen to measure the titanium-zirconium ratio in the Milne rock?
Of course not, Corky sputtered. Nobody would ever measure that. It's like looking at a car and measuring the tire's rubber content to confirm you're looking at a car.
Tallon heaved a sigh and looked back at Xavier. If we give you a rock sample with chondrules in it, can you run a test to determine whether these inclusions are meteoric chondrules or one of Pollock's deep ocean compression things? Xavier shrugged.
I suppose. The electron microprobe's accuracy should be close enough. What's this all about, anyway?
Tallon turned to Corky. Give it to her.
Corky reluctantly pulled the meteorite sample from his pocket and held it out for Xavier.
Xavier's brow furrowed as she took the stone disc. She eyed the fusion crust and then the fossil embedded in the rock.
My God, she said, her head rocketing upward. This isn't part of...
Yeah, Tallon said. Unfortunately, it is.
Chapter 106.
Alone in her office, Gabrielle Ash stood at the window, wondering what to do next. Less than an hour ago, she had left NASA feeling full of excitement to share Chris Harper's pods fraud with the senator. Now, she wasn't so sure. According to Yolanda, two independent ABC reporters suspected Sexton of taking SFF bribes. Furthermore, Gabrielle had just learned that Sexton actually knew she had snuck into his apartment during the SFF meeting, and yet he had said nothing to her about it. Gabrielle sighed. Her taxi had long since departed, and although she would call another in a few minutes, she knew there was something she had to do first. Am I really going to try this? Gabrielle frowned, knowing she didn't have a choice. She no longer knew whom to trust. Stepping out of her office, she made her way back into the secretarial lobby and into a wide hallway on the opposite side. At the far end, she could see the massive oak doors of Sexton's office flanked by two flags, Old Glory on the right and the Delaware flag on the left. His doors, like those of most Senate offices in the building, were steel-reinforced and secured by conventional keys, an electronic keypad entry, and an alarm system. She knew if she could get inside, even if only for a few minutes, all the answers would be revealed. Moving now towards the heavily secured doors, Gabrielle had no illusions of getting through them. She had other plans. 10 feet from Sexton's office, Gabrielle turned sharply to the right and entered the ladies' room. The fluorescence came on automatically, reflecting harshly off the white tile. As her eyes adjusted, Gabrielle paused, seeing herself in the mirror. As usual, her features looked softer than she'd hoped, delicate almost. She always felt stronger than she looked. Are you sure you're ready to do this? Gabrielle knew Sexton was eagerly awaiting her arrival for a complete rundown on the pod situation. Unfortunately, she also now realized that Sexton had deftly manipulated her tonight. Gabrielle Ash did not like being managed. The senator had kept things from her tonight. The question was, how much? The answer, she knew, lay inside his office, just on the other side of this restroom wall. 5 minutes, Gabrielle said aloud, mustering her resolve. Moving toward the bathroom supply closet, she reached up and ran a hand over the doorframe. A key clattered to the floor. The cleaning crews at Philip A. Hart were federal employees and seemed to evaporate every time there was a strike of any sort, leaving this bathroom without toilet paper and tampons for weeks at a time. The women of Sexton's office, tired of being caught with their pants down, had taken matters into their own hands and secured a supply room key for emergencies. Tonight qualifies, she thought. She opened the closet. The interior was cramped, packed with cleansers, mops, and shelves of paper supplies. A month ago, Gabrielle had been searching for paper towels when she'd made an unusual discovery. Unable to reach the paper off the top shelf, she'd used the end of a broom to coax a roll to fall. In the process, she'd knocked out a ceiling tile. When she climbed up to replace the tile, she was surprised to hear Senator Sexton's voice, crystal clear.
From the echo, she realized the senator was talking to himself while in his office's private bathroom, which apparently was separated from this supply closet by nothing more than removable fiberboard ceiling tiles.
Now, back in the closet tonight for far more than toilet paper, Gabrielle kicked off her shoes, climbed up the shelves, popped out the fiberboard ceiling tile, and pulled herself up. So much for national security, she thought, wondering how many state and federal laws she was about to break. Lowering herself through the ceiling of Sexton's private restroom, Gabrielle placed her stockinged feet on his cold porcelain sink and then dropped to the floor. Holding her breath, she exited into Sexton's private office. His oriental carpets felt soft and warm. Chapter 107. 30 miles away, a black Kiowa gunship, Chopper, tore over the scrub pine treetops of northern Delaware. Delta One checked the coordinates locked in the auto navigation system. Although Rachel's shipboard transmission device and Pickering's cell phone were encrypted to protect the contents of the communication, intercepting content had not been the goal when the Delta Force pulse-snitched Rachel's call from sea. Intercepting the caller's position had been the goal. Global positioning systems and computerized triangulation made pinpointing transmission coordinates a significantly easier task than decrypting the actual content of the call. Delta One was always amused to think that most cell phone users had no idea that every time they made a call, a government listening post, if so inclined, could detect their position to within 10 feet anywhere on Earth. A small hitch the cell phone companies failed to advertise. Tonight, once the Delta Force had gained access to the reception frequencies of William Pickering's cellular phone, they could easily trace the coordinates of his incoming calls. Flying now on a direct course toward their target, Delta One closed to within 20 miles. "Umbrella primed?" he asked, turning to Delta Two, who was manning the radar and weapons system. "Affirmative. Awaiting 5-mile range." 5 miles, Delta One thought. He had to fly this bird well within his target's radar scopes to get within range to use the Kiowa's weapons systems. He had little doubt that someone on board the Goya was nervously watching the skies, and because the Delta Force's current task was to eliminate the target without giving them a chance to radio for help, Delta One now had to advance on his prey without alarming them. At 15 miles out, still safely out of radar range, Delta One abruptly turned the Kiowa 35 degrees off course to the west. He climbed to 3,000 feet, small airplane range, and adjusted his speed to 110 knots. On the deck of the Goya, the Coast Guard helicopter's radar scope beeped once as a new contact entered the 10-mile perimeter. The pilot sat up, studying the screen. The contact appeared to be a small cargo plane headed west up the coast, probably for Newark. Although this plane's current trajectory would bring it within 4 miles of the Goya, the flight path obviously was a matter of chance. Nonetheless, being vigilant, the Coast Guard pilot watched the blinking dot trace a slow-moving 110-knot line across the right side of his scope. At its closest point, the plane was about 4 miles west. As expected, the plane kept moving, heading away from them now. 4.1 miles, 4.2 miles. The pilot exhaled, relaxing. And then, the strangest thing happened. "Umbrella now engaged," Delta Two called out, giving the thumbs up from his weapons control seat on the port side of the Kiowa gunship. "Barrage, modulated noise, and cover pulse are all activated and locked." Delta One took his cue and banked hard to the right, putting the craft on a direct course with the Goya. This maneuver would be invisible to the ship's radar. "Sure beats bales of tinfoil," Delta Two called out. Delta One agreed. Radar jamming had been invented in World War II when a savvy British airman began throwing bales of hay wrapped in tinfoil out of his plane while on bombing runs. The Germans' radar spotted so many reflective contacts, they had no idea what to shoot. The techniques had been improved on substantially since then.
The Kiowa's onboard umbrella radar jamming system was one of the military's most deadly electronic combat weapons. By broadcasting an umbrella of background noise into the atmosphere above a given set of surface coordinates, the Kiowa could erase the eyes, ears, and voice of their target. Moments ago, all radar screens aboard the Goya had most certainly gone blank. By the time the crew realized they needed to call for help, they would be unable to transmit. On a ship, all communications were radio or microwave-based, no solid phone lines. If the Kiowa got close enough, all of the Goya's communication systems would stop functioning, their carrier signals blotted out by the invisible cloud of thermal noise broadcast in front of the Kiowa like a blinding headlight. Perfect isolation, Delta One thought. They have no defenses. Their targets had made a fortunate and cunning escape from the Milne ice shelf, but it would not be repeated. In choosing to leave shore, Rachel Sexton and Michael Tolland had chosen poorly. It would be the last bad decision they ever made. Inside the White House, Zach Herney felt dazed as he sat up in bed holding the telephone receiver.
"Now? Ekstrom wants to speak to me now?"
Herney squinted again at the bedside clock, 3:17 a.m.
"Yes, Mr. President," the communications officer said. "He says it's an emergency."
Chapter 108. While Corky and Xavier huddled over the electron microprobe, measuring the zirconium content in the chondrils, Rachel followed Tolan across the lab into an adjoining room. Here Tolan turned on another computer. Apparently the oceanographer had one more thing he wanted to check. As the computer powered up, Tolan turned to Rachel, his mouth poised as if he wanted to say something. He paused.
"What is it?"
Rachel asked, surprised how physically drawn to him she felt, even in the midst of all this chaos. She wished she could block it all out and be with him, just for a minute.
"I owe you an apology," Tolan said, looking remorseful.
"For what?"
"On the deck, the hammerheads. I was excited. Sometimes I forget how frightening the ocean can be to a lot of people."
Face to face with him, Rachel felt like a teenager standing on the doorstep with a new boyfriend.
"Thanks. No problem at all. Really."
Something inside her sensed Tolan wanted to kiss her. After a beat, he turned shyly away.
"I know. You want to get to shore. We should get to work."
"For now,"
Rachel smiled softly.
"For now,"
Tolan repeated, taking a seat at the computer. Rachel exhaled, standing close behind now, savoring the privacy of the small lab. She watched Tolan navigate a series of files.
"What are we doing?"
"Checking the database for big ocean lice. I want to see if we can find any prehistoric marine fossils that resemble what we saw in the NASA meteorite."
He pulled up a search page with bold letters across the top, Project Diversitas. Scrolling through the menu, as Tolland explained, "Diversitas is essentially a continuously updated index of oceanic biodata. When a marine biologist discovers a new ocean species or fossil, he can toot his horn and share his find by uploading data and photos to a central data bank. Because there's so much new data discovered on a weekly basis, this is really the only way to keep research up to date." Rachel watched Tolan navigating the menus.
"So you're accessing the web now?"
"No, internet access is tricky at sea. We store all this data on board, on an enormous array of optical drives in the other room. Every time we're in port, we tie into Project Diversitas and update our data bank with the newest finds. This way we can access data at sea without a web connection, and the data is never more than a month or two out of date."
Tolan chuckled as he began typing search keywords into the computer.
"You probably heard of the controversial music file-sharing program called Napster?"
Rachel nodded.
"Diversitas is considered the marine biologist's version of Napster. We call it Lobster. Lonely oceanic biologists sharing totally eccentric research."
Rachel laughed.
Even in this tense situation, Michael Tolland exuded a wry humor that eased her fears. She was beginning to realize that she'd had entirely too little laughter in her life lately. "Our database is enormous," Tolland said, completing the entry of his descriptive keywords. "Over 10 terabytes of descriptions and photos. There's information in here nobody has ever seen, and nobody ever will. Ocean species are simply too numerous." He clicked the search button. "Okay, let's see if anyone has ever seen an oceanic fossil similar to our little space bug." After a few seconds, the screen refreshed, revealing 4 listings of fossilized animals. Tolland clicked on each listing one by one and examined the photos. None looked remotely like the fossils on the Milne meteorite. Tolland frowned. "Let's try something else." He removed the word fossil from his search string and hit search. "We'll search all living species. Maybe we can find a living descendant that has some of the physiological characteristics of the Milne fossil." The screen refreshed. Again, Tolland frowned. The computer had returned hundreds of entries. He sat a moment, stroking his now stubble-darkened chin. "Okay, this is too much. Let's refine the search." Rachel watched as he accessed a drop-down menu marked Habitat. The list of options looked endless. Tide pool, marsh, lagoon, reef, mid-oceanic ridge, sulfur vents. Tolland scrolled down the list and chose an option that read, "Destructive margins, oceanic trenches." Smart, Rachel realized. Tolland was limiting his search only to species that live near the environment where these chondro-like features were hypothesized to form. The page refreshed. This time, Tolland smiled. Great, only 3 entries. Rachel squinted at the first name on the list. Limulus poly something. Tolland checked the entry. A photo appeared. The creature looked like an oversized horseshoe crab without a tail. Nope, Tolland said, returning to the previous page. Rachel eyed the second item on the list. Shrimpus uglius from Hellas. She was confused. Is that name for real? Tolland chuckled. No, it's a new species not yet classified. The guy who discovered it has a sense of humor. He's suggesting Shrimpus uglius as the official taxonomical classification. Tolland clicked open the photo, revealing an exceptionally ugly, shrimp-like creature with whiskers and fluorescent pink antenna. Aptly named, Tolland said, but not our space bug. He returned to the index. The final offering is? He clicked on the 3rd entry and the page came up. Bithynimus giganteus, Tolland read aloud as the text appeared. The photograph loaded, a full-color close-up. Rachel jumped. My God! The creature staring back at her gave her chills. Tolland drew a low breath. Oh, boy. This guy looks kind of familiar. Rachel nodded, speechless. Bithynimus giganteus. The creature resembled a giant swimming louse. It looked very similar to the fossil species in the NASA rock. There are some subtle differences, Tolland said, scrolling down to some anatomical diagrams and sketches. But it's damn close, especially considering it had 190 million years to evolve. Close is right, Rachel thought. Too close. Tolland read the description on the screen. Thought to be one of the oldest species in the ocean, the rare and recently classified species Bithynimus giganteus is a deep-water scavenging isopod resembling a large pill bug. Up to 2 feet in length, this species exhibits a chitinous exoskeleton segmented into head, thorax, abdomen. It possesses paired appendages, antennae, and compound eyes like those of land-dwelling insects. This bottom-dwelling forager has no known predators and lives in barren, pelagic environments previously thought to be uninhabitable. Tolland glanced up. Which could explain the lack of other fossils in the sample. Rachel stared at the creature on the screen, excited and yet uncertain she completely understood what all this meant. Imagine,
Tallon said excitedly, that 190 million years ago, a brood of these bithymetous creatures got buried in a deep ocean mudslide. As the mud turns into rock, the bugs get fossilized into stone. Simultaneously, the ocean floor, which is constantly moving like a slow conveyor belt toward the oceanic trenches, carries the fossils into a high-pressure zone where the rock forms chondrils. Tallon was talking faster now. And if part of the fossilized, chondrilized crust broke off and ended up on the trench's accretionary wedge, which is not at all uncommon, it would be in a perfect position to be discovered.
But if NASA, Rachel stammered, I mean, if this is all a lie, NASA must have known that sooner or later someone would find out this fossil resembles a sea creature, right? I mean, we just found out.
Tallon began printing the bithymetous photos on a laser printer.
I don't know. Even if someone stepped forward and pointed out the similarities between the fossils and a living sea louse, their physiologies are not identical. It almost proves NASA's case more strongly.
Rachel suddenly understood.
Panspermia.
Life on Earth was seeded from space.
Exactly. Similarities between space organisms and Earth organisms make excellent scientific sense. The sea louse actually strengthens NASA's case.
Except if the meteorite's authenticity is in question.
Tallon nodded.
Once the meteorite comes into question, then everything collapses.
Rachel stood in silence as the bithynomous pages rolled out of the printer. She tried to tell herself this was all an honest NASA mistake, but she knew it wasn't. People who make honest mistakes didn't try to kill people. The nasal voice of Corky echoed suddenly across the lab.
Impossible!
Both Tallon and Rachel turned.
Measure the damn ratio again. It makes no sense.
Xavier came hurrying in with a computer printout clutched in her hand. Her face was ashen.
Mike, I don't know how to say this.
Her voice cracked.
The titanium-zirconium ratios we're seeing in this sample?
She cleared her throat.
It's pretty obvious that NASA made a huge mistake. Their meteorite is an ocean rock.
Tallon and Rachel looked at each other, but neither spoke a word. They knew. Just like that, all the suspicions and doubts had swelled up like the crest of a wave, reaching the breaking point. Tallon nodded, a sadness in his eyes.
Yeah, thanks, Xavier. But I don't understand, Xavier said. The fusion crust, the location in the ice.
We'll explain on the way to shore, Tallon said. We're leaving.
Quickly, Rachel collected all the papers and evidence they now had. The evidence was shockingly conclusive. The GPR printout showing the insertion shaft in the Milne ice shelf, photos of a living sea louse resembling NASA's fossil, Dr. Pollack's article on ocean chondrils, and microprobe data showing ultra-depleted zirconium in the meteorite. The conclusion was undeniable. Fraud. Tallon looked at the stack of papers in Rachel's hands and heaved a melancholy sigh.
Well, I'd say William Pickering has his proof.
Rachel nodded, again wondering why Pickering hadn't answered his phone. Tallon lifted the receiver of a nearby phone, holding it out for her.
You want to try him again from here?
No, let's get moving. I'll try to contact him again from the chopper.
Rachel had already decided if she could not make contact with Pickering, she'd have the Coast Guard fly them directly to the NRO, only about 180 miles. Tallon began to hang up the phone, but he paused. Looking confused, he listened to the receiver, frowning.
Bizarre. No dial tone.
What do you mean?
Rachel said, wary now.
Weird, Tallon said. Direct commsat lines never lose carrier.
Mr. Tallon!
The Coast Guard pilot came rushing into the lab, his face white.
What is it? Rachel demanded. Is someone coming?
That's the problem, the pilot said. I don't know. All onboard radar and communications have just gone dead.
Rachel stuffed the papers deep inside her shirt.
Get in the helicopter. We're leaving. Now.
Chapter 109. Gabrielle's heart was racing as she crossed the darkened office of Senator Sexton.
The room was as expansive as it was elegant. Ornate wood-paneled walls, oil paintings, Persian carpets, leather rivet chairs, and a gargantuan mahogany desk. The room was lit only by the eerie neon glow of Sexton's computer screen. Gabriel moved toward his desk. Senator Sexton had embraced the digital office to maniacal proportions, eschewing the overflow of file cabinets for the compact, searchable simplicity of his personal computer, into which he fed enormous amounts of information. Digitized meeting notes, scanned articles, speeches, brainstorms. Sexton's computer was his sacred ground, and he kept his office locked at all times to protect it. He even refused to connect to the Internet for fear of hackers infiltrating his sacred digital vault. A year ago, Gabriel would never have believed any politician would be stupid enough to store copies of self-incriminating documents. But Washington had taught her a lot. Information is power. Gabriel had been amazed to learn that a common practice among politicians who accepted questionable campaign contributions was to keep actual proof of those donations. Letters, bank records, receipts, logs, all hidden away in a safe place. This counter-blackmail tactic, euphemistically known in Washington as Siamese insurance, protected candidates from donors who felt their generosity somehow authorized them to assert undue political pressure on a candidate. If a contributor got too demanding, the candidate could simply produce evidence of the illegal donation and remind the donor that both parties had broken the law. The evidence ensured that candidates and donors were joined at the hip forever, like Siamese twins. Gabrielle slipped behind the senator's desk and sat down. She took a deep breath, looking at his computer. If the senator is accepting SFF bribes, any evidence would be in here. Sexton's computer screensaver was an ongoing slideshow of the White House and its grounds, created for him by one of his gung-ho staffers who was big into visualization and positive thinking. Around the images crawled a ticker tape banner that read, President of the United States, Sedgwick Sexton. President of the United States, Sedgwick Sexton. President of the... Gabriel jostled the mouse, and a security dialog box came up. Enter password. She expected this. It wouldn't be a problem. Last week, Gabriel had entered Sexton's office just as the senator was sitting down and logging onto his computer. She saw him type three short keystrokes in rapid succession. That's a password? She challenged from the doorway as she walked in. Sexton glanced up. What? And here I thought you were concerned about security, Gabriel scolded good-naturedly. Your password's only three keys? I thought the tech guys told us all to use at least six. The tech guys are teenagers. They should try remembering six random letters when they're over 40. Besides, the door has an alarm. Nobody can get in. Gabriel walked toward him, smiling. What if someone slipped in while you're in the loo? And tried every combination of passwords? He gave a skeptical laugh. I'm slow in the bathroom, but not that slow. Dinner at David says I can guess your password in 10 seconds. Sexton looked intrigued and amused. You can't afford David, Gabriel. So you're saying you're chicken? Sexton appeared almost sorry for her as he accepted the challenge. 10 seconds? He logged off and motioned for Gabriel to sit down and give it a try. You know, I only order the Saltimbocca at David, and that ain't cheap. She shrugged and sat down. It's your money. Enter password. 10 seconds, Sexton reminded. Gabriel had to laugh. She would need only two. Even from the doorway, she could see that Sexton had entered his three-key password in very rapid succession using only his index finger. Obviously all the same key. Not wise. She could also see that his hand had been positioned over the far left side of his keyboard, cutting the possible alphabet down to only about 9 letters. Choosing the letter was simple. Sexton had always loved the triple alliteration of his title, Senator Sedgwick Sexton. Never underestimate the ego of a politician. She typed SSS, and the screensaver evaporated. Sexton's jaw hit the floor. That had been last week.
Now, as Gabrielle faced his computer again, she was certain Sexton would not have taken time yet to figure out how to set up a different password. Why would he? He trusts me implicitly. She typed in SSS. Invalid password, access denied. Gabrielle stared in shock. Apparently she had overestimated her senator's level of trust. Chapter 110. The attack came without warning. Low, out of the southwest sky above the Goya, the lethal silhouette of a gunship helicopter bore down like a giant wasp. Rachel had no doubt what it was or why it was here. Through the darkness, a staccato burst from the nose of the chopper sent a torrent of bullets chewing across the Goya's fiberglass deck, slashing a line across the stern. Rachel dove for cover too late and felt the searing slash of a bullet graze her arm. She hit the ground hard, then rolled, scrambling to get behind the bulbous, transparent dome of the Triton submersible. A thunder of rotors exploded overhead as the chopper swooped past the ship. The noise evaporated with an eerie hiss as the chopper rocketed out over the ocean and began a wide bank for a second pass. Lying trembling on the deck, Rachel held her arm and looked back at Tolland and Corky. Apparently having lunged to cover behind a storage structure, the two men were now staggering to their feet, their eyes scanning the skies in terror. Rachel pulled herself to her knees. The entire world suddenly seemed to be moving in slow motion. Crouched behind the transparent curvature of the Triton sub, Rachel looked in panic toward their only means of escape, the Coast Guard helicopter. Xavier was already climbing into the chopper's cabin, frantically waving for everyone to get aboard. Rachel could see the pilot lunging into the cockpit, wildly throwing switches and levers. The blades began to turn, ever so slowly. Too slowly. Hurry! Rachel felt herself standing now, preparing to run, wondering if she could make it across the deck before the attackers made another pass. Behind her, she heard Corky and Tolland dashing toward her and the waiting helicopter. Yes, hurry! Then she saw it. 100 yards out, up in the sky, materializing out of empty darkness, a pencil-thin beam of red light slanted across the night, searching the Goya's deck. Then finding its mark, the beam came to a stop on the side of the waiting Coast Guard chopper. The image took only an instant to register. In that horrific moment, Rachel felt all the action on the deck of the Goya blur into a collage of shapes and sounds. Tolland and Corky dashing toward her, Xavier motioning wildly in the helicopter, the stark red lasers slicing across the night sky. It was too late. Rachel spun back toward Corky and Tolland, who were running full speed now toward the helicopter. She lunged outward into their path, arms outstretched, trying to stop them. The collision felt like a train wreck as the three of them crashed to the deck in a tangle of arms and legs. In the distance, a flash of white light appeared. Rachel watched in disbelief and horror as a perfectly straight line of exhaust fire followed the path of the laser beam directly toward the helicopter. When the Hellfire missiles slammed into the fuselage, the helicopter exploded apart like a toy. The concussion wave of heat and noise thundered across the deck as flaming shrapnel rained down. The helicopter's flaming skeleton lurched backward on its shattered tail, teetered a moment, and then fell off the back of the ship, crashing into the ocean in a hissing cloud of steam. Rachel closed her eyes, unable to breathe. She could hear the flaming wreckage gurgling and sputtering as it sank, being dragged away from the Goya by the heavy currents. In the chaos, Michael Tolland's voice was yelling. Rachel felt his powerful hands trying to pull her to her feet, but she couldn't move. The Coast Guard pilot and Xavier are dead. We are next. Chapter 111. The weather on the Milne ice shelf had settled, and the Havisphere was quiet. Even so, NASA Administrator Lawrence Ekstrom had not even tried to sleep. He had spent the hours alone, pacing the dome, staring into the extraction pit,
running his hands over the grooves in the giant charred rock. Finally, he'd made up his mind. Now he sat at the videophone in the Habosphere's PSC tank and looked into the weary eyes of the President of the United States. Zach Herney was wearing a bathrobe and did not look at all amused. Ekstrom knew he would be significantly less amused when he learned what Ekstrom had to tell him. When Ekstrom finished talking, Herney had an uncomfortable look on his face, as if he thought he must still be too asleep to have understood correctly.
"Hold on," Herney said. "We must have a bad connection. Did you just tell me that NASA intercepted this meteorite's coordinates from an emergency radio transmission, and then pretended that pods found the meteorite?"
Ekstrom was silent, alone in the dark, willing his body to awake from this nightmare. The silence clearly didn't sit well with the President.
"For Christ's sake, Larry, tell me this isn't true."
Ekstrom's mouth went dry.
"The meteorite was found, Mr. President. That is all that's relevant here." "I said, tell me this is not true."
The hush swelled to a dull roar in Ekstrom's ears.
"I had to tell him," Ekstrom told himself. "It's going to get worse before it gets better." "Mr. President, the pod's failure was killing you in the polls, sir. When we intercepted a radio transmission that mentioned a large meteorite lodged in the ice, we saw a chance to get back in the fight."
Herney sounded stunned.
By faking a pod's discovery? Pod's was going to be up and running soon, but not soon enough for the election. The polls were slipping, and Sexton was slamming NASA, so... Are you insane? You lied to me, Larry. The opportunity was staring us in the face, sir. I decided to take it. We intercepted the radio transmission of the Canadian who made the meteorite discovery. He died in a storm. Nobody else knew the meteorite was there. Pods was orbiting the area. NASA needed a victory. We had the coordinates.
Why are you telling me this now?
I thought you should know.
Do you know what Sexton would do with this information if he found out? Ekstrom preferred not to think about it.
He'd tell the world that NASA and the White House lied to the American people. And you know what? He'd be right. You did not lie, sir. I did. And I will step down if...
Larry, you're missing the point. I've tried to run this presidency on truth and decency.
God damn it! Tonight was clean, dignified. Now I find out I lied to the world.
Only a small lie, sir.
There's no such thing, Larry,
Herney said, steaming. Ekstrom felt the tiny room closing in around him. There was so much more to tell the president, but Ekstrom could see it should wait until morning.
I'm sorry to have woken you, sir. I just thought you should know.
Across town, Sedgwick Sexton took another hit of cognac and paced his apartment with rising irritation. Where the hell is Gabrielle? Chapter 112. Gabrielle Ash sat in the darkness at Senator Sexton's desk and gave his computer a despondent scowl. Invalid password, access denied. She had tried several other passwords that seemed likely possibilities, but none had worked. After searching the office for any unlocked drawers or stray clues, Gabrielle had all but given up. She was about to leave when she spotted something odd, shimmering on Sexton's desk calendar. Someone had outlined the date of the election in red, white, and blue glitter pen. Certainly not the senator. Gabrielle pulled the calendar closer. Emblazoned across the date was a frilly, glittering exclamation. POTUS. Sexton's ebullient secretary had apparently glitter-painted some more positive thinking for him for Election Day. The acronym POTUS was the U.S. Secret Service's code name for President of the United States.
On election day, if all went well, Sexton would become the new POTUS. Preparing to leave, Gabrielle realigned the calendar on his desk and stood up. She paused suddenly, glancing back at the computer screen. Enter password. She looked again at the calendar. POTUS. She felt a sudden surge of hope.